To introduce our main speaker for this evening, Chris D. from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 5th, 2008. I want to apologize ahead of time if I, part of my story is not just alcohol, it's drugs. I do try to respect AA to the best of my ability, but if something comes out as far as drugs is concerned, I want to apologize with no respect to anyone or the meeting. You know, I was asked all day, are you nervous? Are you nervous? I was, no. And then I look out and I'm like, oh, shit, I am. Oops, sorry. Okay. Okay. You know, when I first came to recovery, I thought my story began when I started drinking. And since being in recovery and doing my first step, I've learned that my story started way before my drinking and using. It was just a symptom of the problem itself. So a little bit about me. I hope I don't stay too drunk too long, because the best part of, I believe, is the hope and the blessings and the promises and everything that comes from recovery. But I do want to tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in the Philippines. I was raised there. My parents were, bear with me, it's a little confusing because even I have a hard time still remembering it all. I was born in the Philippines. My dad was Air Force. However, I was left there when I was first born, and I grew up the first 6-7 years to a lady I called aunt, or my mom. I called her mom, and I called her my uncle dad, and that's who I thought was my mom and dad. While I was in the Philippines, there was a lot of molestation going on. It wasn't just a one-time thing. It was a regular thing. And one day at around 5 or 6 years, no, I think I was 6 or 7, I was introduced to my aunt and uncle. We met at the beach. They asked me if I wanted to come see where they live at Clark Air Force Base. They had chocolate. I'm like, okay, you know, at 6 years old. And I never went back. One day I'm calling them aunt and uncle. The next day I'm calling them mom and dad. And I find it interesting when I think about it. I never questioned it. I never thought about it. I never missed, you know, like, why am I not going back home? I just accepted it. So the molestation ended when I moved in with them, started living with them, but the abuse began. And my dad was one of those, he was a happy drunk. We loved getting him drunk, you know. I'm serious. I remember everything. He was in the Air Force, and everything revolved around drinking. All the barbecues revolved around drinking. All the dinners, you know. It was just about drinking. That is what the main thing was about. And the women would get together, and they'd have their sweet drinks, margaritas and pina coladas, all that good stuff. And like I said, my dad was a happy drunk. So I learned how to make his drinks really early, and I enjoyed it. I wanted him to get drunk, because when he was sober, he was not nice. I missed a lot of schools. I've had a cast on just about every part of me, this arm, this leg, you know, and it's the same story. I fell, or something happened there, you know, I fell off my bike, or whatever, you know. As far as the schools were concerned, I was very accident prone. But so that's how it was for the next, until I was 18. I would have drinks during the holidays, like Christmas. They would let me have a margarita or a pina colada or champagne. And I, looking back now, you know, when I first got sober, I used to say that I liked it. But when looking back now, I understand the reason why I started drinking, and I started drinking alcoholically at such a young age is because of the molestation. I learned in my first step that I was numb, and I just wanted to feel something. And so the drinking made me feel warm. It made me come alive, you know. And I'm one of those, because my dad was Air Force, I didn't stay in a place more than 3 or 4 years. We were always being transferred. So I was the loner. I was the one that didn't know someone. I was the new kid in school. I was the one, it was just hard making friends because I was going to be leaving them. So eventually, I believe my junior high, I started seeing people, you know, this group, the girls in the bathroom with a joint and some drinks, you know, in between classes. And I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be cool like them. So I would take, my dad used to collect the little liquor bottles from all over different countries. And because me being so slick and I got this, I would empty those little bottles into a big bottle and replace it with either tea because it looks the same, you know, or 7-Up because it's clear, like the vodka's clear. And so they wouldn't know, right? At least that's what I thought. But that's how it started. And I would take it to school. And I thought, you know, for the first time in my life, I had friends. Or at least I thought so. You know, I had friends and I was cool and I was hanging out with the cool kids. I'm not really sure how I made it through high school because a lot of it, I was the one, you know, like I said, looking back now, I began drinking alcoholically because I was the one that would come into class, sit in the back room and be passed out. And then the next second, I know class is over and we go to the next class. So, but I didn't get that. And I wasn't like the rest of them where they just drink to get a buzz. I drank until I was out. And again, looking back, I see where it all began. So when I finish, and I apologize if I go too fast, I shouldn't have had that last cup of coffee. And if you see me going like this, you'll know why. Because of the last cup of coffee. Anyway, when I finished school, I came straight to San Diego. Just real quick, I did have a brother. He was left in the Philippines. He came out to live with us at the age 16 for 2 years, but my dad kicked him out because he stood up to him one day when he was abusing my mom. So he joined the Navy. He was stationed in San Diego, and I came out, you know, as soon as I finished school, I came out here, and for the first time in my life, it was like freedom, like, you know. And so I met this lady. We would hang out at the beach. She was blonde, nice tan, blue eyes, a true California girl. And so I'm like, hey, this is cool. I'm in California, hanging out with the California girls. We're getting high. We're drinking. I mean, this is great. This is what I'm talking about. And one day, you know, we'd always meet out there on the beach, and then one day she says to me that she's trying to get away from an abusive relationship when I go with her to Phoenix. Well, I got nothing better to do. Okay, so off to Phoenix we go. And in Phoenix, you know, the drinking started getting worse and worse because we'd have vodka and orange juice for breakfast, vodka and 7-Up for lunch. And I think it went straight to vodka by dinner time, if I even made it that far, you know. And but that lasted, I believe, a month or two until the money started to go. And apparently she had called her boyfriend, which come to find out was her pimp. And he came down to Phoenix, and he beat me, and he raped me, and he beat me, and he raped me. This went on for like a week or so. And then he took me to Northern California. And people ask, why didn't I try to leave? And I got to be honest with you, I was either too drunk and too in shock. Like, I didn't know what, I just came from my home. I what the hell? This doesn't happen. This only happens on TV or movies. So I don't know why I didn't run. But anyway, he took me and my friend, his girlfriend, up to Northern California. And there he kind of kept me in a room and he pretty much sold me. You know, he would bring men in, and they'd do whatever they wanted, and he got money. And I remember, you know, looking back today, I remember as long as I had my eye on that vodka, I was okay. Because I knew once it was done, I can have my vodka, you know. And that went on for a couple of months, and then eventually he trusted me to go out on the streets to bring men back. I don't know what changed, but as soon as I got out on the street, I went to a policeman. I was drunk. I probably smelled like vodka. I mean, I just was just ripped. And I go up to the first policeman I see, and I'm like, and he's like, why, you know? I don't remember what all I said, but all I remember is that they put me in a shelter. They called my brother in San Diego, and I went back down there to live with him, but there I took a bottle of sleeping pills because I believed all the threats he said to me, that he was going to come find me, he's going to either find my brother or he's going to kill us, and all the threats that come with it. And I believed him, and I started freaking out. And again, I just want to, you know, remind you that I was 18 years old when this happened. I was just fresh from leaving my home. I don't know any, I had no experience in street life or whatever. And so I took a bottle of pills, and all that did was make me hallucinate. And my brother would come home, and he'd find me under a pile of laundry clothes and freaking out, screaming at him, he's here, you know. And he didn't know, he was in the Navy, and he didn't know what to do with me. So, you know what, I apologize, it was in Oceanside, Camp Pendleton. So he took me down to some friends in San Diego, and apparently I was pregnant, and I didn't know it. And he didn't know what to do about it because he had his career and stuff. So as I stayed with some friends, I was able to find an adoption agency. And this whole time I was pregnant, I was still drinking and other things, you know. I was just, the only word I can think of was just numb. Like, did all of this really just happen, you know? It was supposed to be Disneyland as soon as I left home, and it turned out to be total opposite. And so I found an adoption agency. I got to meet the parents. I got to choose the parents, you know, and I picked the parents because they had had a bedroom for this baby for 3 years, and I thought, how cool is that, that they wanted something so bad for that long that they were being patient. So I chose them, as well as the fact that they had brown hair and brown eyes, you know, just anyway. I remember that when I went in labor, that they beat me. My friend that I was living with called them, and they beat me to the hospital. And I remember being wheeled into the in a wheelchair in the hospital, and there was a grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles, cousins, husband, wife. And I'm like, how cool is that, that this baby is coming to this huge family? And I was really grateful for that. I was really grateful for that. Anyway, after the baby was born, I didn't know what to do, so I joined the Army. I figured my brother's Navy, my dad's Air Force, that only leaves Marine or Army, and I was not going to be a grunt. That, for those of you that don't know, that's what I don't know why, but in my head, so I'm not going to be a grunt. So I went in as a psych tech, and I came out as a truck driver. Go figure. But, you know, and I did fine in the military. I did 3x3, and you know, my drinking kind of slowed down. We drink beer, a lot of more beer than hard liquor. We do it at night, but I was still restless. Something inside of me was looking, searching. I was just discontent. There's got to be more to life than the military. You know, I grew up in a military base. My family is military. All I knew is military. There's got to be more. And so I got out of the military, and one, that was probably one of the worst mistakes I've made. However, nothing is in God's world. It happens by mistake, so I guess there was lessons for me to learn. Plenty of lessons. When I got out of the Army, I came back down to Oceanside, and there began drugs and alcohol, and it became a whirlwind. I'm just going to speed it up. That from that point to 45 years old, I was in and out of jail. I never kept a job, always getting evicted. I was losing friends, and I just, you know, so many times I remember thinking to myself, God, I have such bad luck with people. You know, man, if I could just find the right people, I would have it made. You know, they leave me alone. I'd go drinking and dancing and having time. The cops that keeps pulling me over, I mean, they're bored or something. They're like, you got nothing better to do than harass me and keep putting me in jail, you know. And the probation officers, man, they just don't give you a break. They want to test you all the time. You know, and I could never pass it. That's how my disease went, that it didn't matter about, that I know that I'm going to be tested tomorrow or 3 days. I couldn't stop. You know, I remember thinking that when I was working, is that, okay, I'd only drink in the weekend. Okay, I'll only drink during the holidays. That didn't work. Okay, I'll only drink when I get paid. Okay, that didn't work. Okay, I'll only, you know. And what the bottom line was, we don't really need excuses. I mean, I drank because there was no reason to drink. I drank because it's someone's birthday. I drank because it wasn't anyone's birthday, you know. Well, hell, until then, let's celebrate. I mean, you see what I'm getting at, I hope, is that, but that I had lost, I became powerless. I had to drink and drug. You know, it didn't matter. As soon as I go to jail, I 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, it didn't matter. While I'm in jail, I would say, okay, I'm not doing it. And, you know, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I'm going to do it different. But the day I get out, it's boom, right back to the same thing. And I couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand that. The insanity of it all. Getting evicted, being homeless. So, I don't want to stay drunk, like I said, too long, but leading up to it is that as many times, somewhere in between there, I did get pregnant again. I was going to give him up for adoption, but let me just say, the whole time I was pregnant, I didn't see a doctor. I didn't take care of myself. I was continuously drinking and drugging. I just couldn't stop. I had sold everything in my house for drugs. There was nothing there, but I just couldn't stop, you know. The baby was born, and the nurse didn't know that I was going to give him up for adoption, and they put him in my arms, and something, you know, like, oh my God, what do I do with this baby? And another reason why I didn't want him is I figured, oh, I'm so sorry, let me back up. I knew this is a coffee. I got into an accident, car accident. It took me a few months to walk and talk again. While I was in the hospital, I was in a coma for a week. They couldn't tell me I was pregnant. Very important. I forgot it, huh? It's the coffee, I tell you. You know, but they couldn't tell me I was pregnant. So I figured between all the x-rays they were taking every day, the intravenous morphine, the impact of the accident, the drugs and alcohol that I was doing, there was going to be something wrong with that baby, and I just couldn't take it. I just couldn't handle it, you know. And the baby was born. I put him in my arms, and he was healthy and strong, and, you know, that was a God thing. But I didn't see that then. He lived with me for the first 5 or 6 years, but again, I just couldn't stop no matter what. I just couldn't stop, you know. He missed school. So many times, you know, I would lock myself in the room and he'd be knocking at 3 years old, you know, asking for mom, being hungry. I'll be out in a minute. And I couldn't stop. I couldn't come out and feed my son. I couldn't get him to school. I couldn't do anything that a mom should have been doing for him, you know. And finally, the last time I went to jail, a very close friend of mine, we agreed and verbal agreement she would take care of him. And that, to me, was a perfect alibi that I could just go right on to what I'm doing. And I did. It got way worse. You know, like I said, I don't want to disrespect AA, but it became to where I was using the needle. I just didn't care anymore. I just didn't care. The last time I got out of jail, I had nothing except a shirt on my back, no ID or nothing, and that was the beginning of my homelessness, you know. A lady took me under her wing and showed me where to sleep, where not to go, where's a good place, where's a safe place, where's not a safe place, and that's where I lived for the last 4 years of my disease, you know. I remember thinking one time, like, sitting there, like, how the hell did I get to this point, you know? I was great at school. My dad, I had a good home. I was in the army. I'm not stupid. I mean, how the hell am I sitting here on a curb? Where'd I go wrong? But as long as I had that vodka or whatever I could get my hands, that thought went right out the window. While I was homeless, I did everything I could to survive. I sold my body, my mind, my soul. I did everything I could to survive. You know, and I did, but the only thing that got me started thinking about getting into help, I'm going to say help, because when I did go into a recovery home, I didn't go in there to say that I needed help for my disease. I went in there because everyone I knew the first 4 years was either dead, in an institution, in prison, or 5150. And I knew my luck was going to run out. After 4 years of living in the streets and sleeping behind dumpsters and bushes and hiding my stuff in bushes and, you know, just things like that, not eating for days, just drinking was my companion. As long as I had enough money to get my drink, I was okay. My mission was complete for the day, and then I'd start all over the next day, you know. And like I said, after 4 years of that, I started getting scared. So I started looking up for help for women, and not help for my disease. It was help to get me off the streets, and I found this place called Crossroads. And they make it sound like, you know, they're going to help you get a job and help you get clothes and get you all, you know, everything that you need. And so, hey, that's the place for me. Okay, that's all I need was help, right, getting started again, and then I can go right back to what I'm doing. So I go into this recovery home, and they're talking about, like, 12 steps and a sponsor and going to meetings. I'm like, what the? No, that's not what I signed up for. I just need help getting a job and getting some clothes, you know. But I started listening to the women, and I started listening to their stories. I'm like, oh, wow, they went through that too? Oh, wow, that happened to them too? Oh, wow, they felt the same thing too? And I'm like, so the more I listened, the more I heard that I wasn't alone. And the more, you know, and I met beautiful women in recovery, like my sponsor and her sponsor and her sponsor's sponsor. And I started thinking, like, oh, wow, maybe there's hope. Maybe I'm not the biggest screw-up that I screwed my whole life. And just I have nothing to show for except pain and misery and a son that wasn't talking to me, you know. All right, so the more I listened, the more I learned. The more I learned, the more I wanted. So I go into this recovery home, and they say you got to do the steps. And they say you got to do step one. I'm like, you want me to tell my whole life story to a stranger? Oh, hell no. However, I did it anyway because I did not want to go back to where I came from. That, you know, it took me a long time to understand what they mean about the gift of desperation. At that point, I just didn't want to go back to where I came from, so I was willing to do whatever it took. If you told me to stand on my head, I would have. Just tell me what to do, because drugs and alcohol wasn't working anymore. All it did was intensify the pain, you know, and please just tell me what to do. And so whatever my sponsor at the time, you know, said, I did. I was one of those that always asked, well, what does that mean? Well, wait a minute, what does that mean? Well, I don't understand, so I'd go to like 10 different people asking the same question, because I just wanted to understand. I just wanted to understand because I was desperate. So I opened up my first step, and I learned, like, you know, she used to say, thank God for drugs and alcohol. I would not have survived all the stuff I went through if it wasn't for that. Can you imagine my surprise when I realized that all that shit would have been happening if it wasn't for drugs and alcohol? Ouch! You know, that was a hard lesson. You know, and then they say, come to believe to a power greater than yourself. Well, you know, when I did my first step and I realized, you know what? I didn't survive living on the streets and everything, you know, the drive-by shootings, seeing people die. I mean, I can tell you, and I don't want to go into it because, like I said, I want to get into recovery, but I can tell you lots of stories of death and watching people die and overdose and everything that comes with living on the streets, you know. And so I do my first step and I realize, wow, I didn't make it out of there by luck or because I'm slick, hip, and cool. There must have been something or someone watching me. I don't know what that was, but I came out of there pretty good, considering. You know, like, and it was like chills, like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, this God thing. And then made a decision to turn my will and over. Well, that was fairly easy because I had I can't remember if it was my sponsor or my therapist that told me, write a letter to your son. And I got as far as, well, I didn't even get that far because I'd say, dear Christopher, no, that's too formal. Dear son, no, that's a little formal. Hey, son, no, that's too casual. Hey, Christopher, because I hadn't talked to him or seen him in 7-8 years, maybe longer. I just didn't know how to start it off. I didn't get any further than that because I just didn't know. And then my sponsor, my therapist said, okay, write a letter to God. And God, what? And I was, okay, like I said, I'm willing to do whatever is suggested. So I got me, you know, little, what do you call those, yellow pads, legal pads. And, all right, I started with Dear God. And before I knew it, I had like 3 or 4 pages front and back. And I'm like, whoa, I sure have a lot to say to God for someone that doesn't believe in God. You know? I did. You know, and what I learned from that is that it wasn't that I didn't believe in him, it's because I was afraid of him. Because the way I was raised, I'm going to go to hell. I'm going to go to hell for this and this and this and this, for the way I look, for what I believe, for what I think, for what I don't. I'm going to hell. But I realized that because back to my first step, I survived all that, and that wasn't luck. So clearly, there must be a reason I'm still alive. You know, in the streets, I've seen girls get beat up at 2 o'clock in the morning walking down the alley. That's another thing I was going to say. By this point, the kind of person my disease had created was that I'd watch a girl get beat up by her pimp, and the only thing I could say is, oh, she must not have reached her quota. Hey, you know, and I think back, and like, that could have been me. That could have been me getting beat. Or getting pimped out or whatever. I saw someone take a hit of crack and jump off the 7th floor in the hotel in National City. And all we could do is just like, whoa, check that out. That could have been me. You know, that is the kind of person I had become. And I look back and I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. You know, and I'm just grateful, you know. So, again, when I came into recovery, I didn't come in to get help for my addiction or disease. I came in just to get help, to get a job and get clothes and get back on track. But what I've gotten is that they're making amends. You know, there's this one certain amend that still stands out because it's to my mom. That's another story I didn't tell you guys. I left home at 18, and I never looked back, and I didn't find my mom. I started looking for her at the age 42, I believe. I even wrote Sally and Oprah and all those Montel, you know, like writing, hey, you know, because, you know, it was a big thing a few years back, reuniting families, you know. And they didn't even write back. That's to be my resentment. None of them wrote back. But however... Anyway, someone told me you should write a letter to Lackland Air Force, is it Lackland? I forget, the one in San Antonio, I apologize. And they said, you can put a letter inside an envelope, put that envelope in another envelope, and they can forward it to my mom and dad because I was trying to find them. I had come, I'd searched for them for so many years, so I figured that by the time I find them, because I hadn't seen them in 30 years, that they would probably be dead. But so I sent this letter, you know, hi, this is Christy. I don't know if you remember me. I'm your daughter. I didn't know what to say in that letter. You know, I don't even know why I wanted to find them anymore. Cause I had a lot of resentment towards them. My mom for not protecting me, you know, and one of the reasons why I said my story started way back before my drinking is because I had emotionally become numb at such a young age. That I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to love my son. I was talking to someone not too long ago, and she was sharing that she had a problem with talking to her son, that she didn't know what to say. And I said, you know what? It's okay, because I have the same problem. 5 minutes seems like 5 hours, because we don't know what to say to each other. We're strangers. But it's okay, because we're there. We're making the effort. And that's the same thing that's going on with my son. Okay, can I just reel my brain back in, because it went right out the window? And where was I actually? Oh, yes, my parents. Thank you. So I'd forgotten I had sent them. Thank you, whoever said that. That was cool. Someone's listening. I had forgotten about that letter, and about 6 or 7 months later, I got a letter. I got something back. It was from my dad. They had divorced when I first left home. He had remarried. He lived in Mexico with another lady, but my mom had stayed in the same house, the same place, waiting for me to come home. I had figured because they were in the Air Force, they probably had moved around so many times, but apparently they had divorced when I left home. She had hired a detective to find me, and the detective told her, took her money and said that he had seen my body in a morgue in Oceanside. All right, so however, this is what's cool about moms. She never gave up hope. She said she knew deep in her heart I was not dead. Even though her families and her sisters were trying to tell her, let her rest in peace, she would still put my picture up next to the Christmas tree every Christmas. And so when I finally did find her, and my dad gave me her phone number, and I called her, she kept hanging up on me. And I'm like, see, I knew she didn't want to get in touch with me, because if police can find me, she could have found me, right? At least that's what I thought, you know? And she kept hanging up because she was watching Oprah. She loves Oprah. And there, you know, these scams that people will call and say, this is your long-lost child. And she wasn't sure if that was me. So she called an aunt that I had in National City. I went down there, and she stuck her head out there. And if you think I'm short, she is short. She's back there. And she stuck her head out. She's like, it's you, it's you, it's really you. And I'm like, who do you think it was going to be? And she took my arm, and she's like, what are you doing? She goes, my birthmark is right here. And she was trying to look for my birthmark. And she called my mom right away, and my mom flew out that week, and we had, you know, and we started building a relationship since then. She's not the same lady that I left at 18 years old. You know, she says things like, I love you today. She never said that when I was growing up. You know, there was no love, no attention, no affection, no nothing. Just a lot of physical abuse. Anyway, so we've been rebuilding that relationship. So in my program, I remember the first time, oh, you know what? I am so sorry. Congratulations. Welcome to the newcomers. Congratulations to the cake takers and the 90 days. That's freaking awesome, because you know what? When I was new and someone would come up here with 10 years, I know, I told you it was the coffee. I pre-warned you. When someone would say 10 years, I'm like, oh, that is not doable. You got to be crazy, you know. But when someone would take a 30-day, 60-day, 90-day, even 1 year, I'm like, okay, all right, maybe I can do that. So that's really cool, and that's really important, you know, because for me as a newcomer, 10 years, that's not even in the picture. Forget it. So congratulations. Ashley, where was I? All right, so I get into recovery. I do my steps, you know, and making amends. I'm still making amends. And that's probably going to be a lifelong process. There's going to be certain amends I cannot make. And I do that living amends. I do right by people. I do my best. What I can tell you is, besides that I'm sweating right now because I feel like it's almost time, huh? All I can tell you is that the person that walked in here in 10 years, almost 10 years ago, was someone that couldn't even look at you in the eye, someone that couldn't even talk to you. You know, I wore these big clothes, big shirts, big pants, and my grand sponsors over there reminding me about a cap. I used to wear a cap because I didn't even want you to see me, because if you see me, you might not like me. If you know, and they say, well, let us love you until you can love yourself. Bullshit. You don't know me. How the hell are you going to love me? And if you did know me, you're not going to love me. If you knew all the things I've done, there's no, you probably even asked me to leave Crossroads. You know, that's how I felt. And so, yes, I wore that cap so I could hide from people. But little by little, as like I said, by listening to other women share and giving me hope. I remember the first time I looked in the mirror and I looked in there, like, I was telling some of the ladies, I'm like, I didn't realize I had some big brown eyes until I got sober. First time I looked in the mirror, like, whoa, Chris, you got some big brown eyes. I know, isn't that cool? Like, I'm talking to myself, and I don't even take meds. Like, that's cool, okay. But, you know, all I can say is that it took time, and it took time because thank God for this program. You know, pretty soon, someone had given me an assignment to look in the mirror, and it took me for a long time. And the first thing I noticed, I had big brown eyes. And then the next thing I noticed, I started caring. I didn't care before. I didn't give a shit. I didn't want you guys to notice. You know, I tried to kill myself before I got into recovery. And, you know, I try to jump in front of cars. They don't go too fast in the city streets. So I try to jump in front of the trolley because they really go too fast. I couldn't do it because there's people in the trolley and I didn't want to traumatize them. But I was timing it. I was standing there on the trolley tracks, but something in me couldn't do it. It's something in me, you know. And Anyway, so I started getting pride. You know, I remember looking in the mirror like, does this shirt match my pants? You know, I used to wear big baggy pants and big baggy shirts because I just didn't want to be seen with my cap. And then pretty soon I remember, hey, does this shirt match my pants? And, oh, I need to be ironed. Oh, you know, and, oh, I need a haircut. And that's my thing now is don't touch my hair. Because I work hard at it and he's telling me get it done. So here's the bottom line. People, is that all I can tell you is that recovery has given me a new life. It's like almost being reborn. It's given me more than hope. It's given me my son back. It's given me my mom back. It's given me trust and friends and a life. Because before I got into recovery, I was not even existing. I was just an empty shell. You know, an empty shell just doing day by day. Today I do it day by day, but in a different way, you know, in recovery. Today I'm trusted. Like I said, I'm blessed to be able to work with women and share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, I'm blessed also because every day there's something that reminds me of where I don't want to be. But at the same time, I have the heart and compassion because I've been there. You know, all I can say if you're new, please do everything that is suggested. What have you got to lose versus what have you got to gain? And I can tell you that everything I've gained since I first came in here is more than words can describe. You know, it's brought me because I didn't even have me. I didn't know me. I was, you know, I was just a numb walking shell. And because of this program and because of the women, you know, all I can say is women stick with the women. Men stick with the men. As far as working these steps and working your program, they will lead you. Do what you're, hang around with the winners. Hang around with people that what you want from them, that they have what you want. You know, because this is about life and death. You know, all I can say is I can't change how I got here, but I do have the power of what I do from this point forward. And today I choose to live. Today I choose to live and appreciate this blessing that God has given me because not everybody gets this blessing. Not everybody gets this blessing of being able to come in here and work on ourselves and change and grow and be there, become a better person. And I am so grateful for all the women that's come ahead of me, all the women that support me and are here tonight, all the women that has taught me, you know, and thank God for my God that given me this opportunity to be here and be of service to you guys tonight. So I hope you guys got something. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic.